Well, good day and welcome back to another special episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we're back with a part two of a two-part segment here. It seems like we've been doing that a lot lately, but we just had such good topics and good guests on the show that we haven't wanted to cut our discussion short, but we want to respect your time and know that, the 25 to 30 minute time slot for this show seems to be about right. So I want to just welcome you all back. We're going to be talking a little bit more about hostile intruders, mass casualty incidents with active shooters and those kind of situations, and talk a little bit about the numbers behind that in this episode. But before we get to that, I want to thank and welcome again my esteemed co-host, Sam Bradley. Sam, how the heck are you?
I'm loving this topic, Jamie, and it's just one of these things that doesn't want to go away because we're all so passionate about it. And the new term, hostile MCI, it just seems like all the time these things are morphing into something different and more inclusive of different kinds of ways people hurt each other, and it's scary. But we like to stay on top of it, and I'm glad we're continuing to discuss it. And, of course, we have Dr. Joe Holly with us, who has brought his guest back for us. Joe?
Well, hi, guys. Great to be here again, and certainly a pleasure to finish up the subject with Bob Otter with Kingfisher Medical.
And we'll jump right back into that segment now. So stay tuned here to disasterpodcast.com for all of these topics. And we'll be revisiting this topic again even next week because we've just got a lot to discuss about this. So stay tuned to the show. Subscribe to the podcast. Find it in iTunes. Find it in your podcast apps. And go ahead and keep bringing it to yourself. But let's jump back into that hostile MCI discussion we had with Bob Otter from Kingfisher Medical. You know, Bob, I'd like to dive into the numbers a little bit here that you talked about in the course of the show. Do you have time to stick around with us a little bit longer?
I absolutely do. Hopefully I'll pull up some references here so I'm accurate with them, because that's the most important thing. But yes, I'm more than happy to stick around.
Well, great. Well, let's talk a little bit about the numbers that we've talked about. You made a comment earlier that we're seeing an increase in these types of events. And I know you've probably got the statistics to back that up, because I had heard that, you know, that these types of incidents have happened. It's the media hype surrounding them that makes them seem more prevalent. So which is true?
Well, you know, the FBI released a study here in the last 7 days that is pretty telling, and it was picked up by a number of different news outlets, from, you know, the Washington Post to the New York Times, all the way to Rolling Stone did a piece on it. And it was it was pretty telling, and the data is out there. And what I'll do, Jamie, is I will send you the PDF that's directly from the FBI that all of these news articles picked up on. But basically, it said that these events have magnified in numbers dramatically over the last 3, 4, 5 years. And yes, obviously more and more media attention is being drawn to it, but I think that is a direct parallel to the number of events going up. And I'll give you that data so your listeners can access it and use it for their own purposes internally.
Great, because I think that it's, you know, as you said, with your video making heads turn and getting minds changed, you know, I think having the data in front of us is what's going to help some of these organizations, jurisdictions, and government agencies make a change and a shift in the way that they deal with these types of things. Because there's some of that head in the sand mentality that, it won't happen in our community.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that. So you look at these different events, and if you look at the not only the numbers but where they're happening, and if you can find any kind of reasoning as to the perpetrators, to what they were doing, you can find an example or a reason, or, you know, if you can call it a reason, but in wherever you are, and it's sad, and I wish there was better answers as to why they're increasing, but they are, and I think we just need to be prepared for them.
And a couple of the points that they made are, the shooting is one thing, but there's also a number of them that have employed IEDs, and there's other cases where these people have finished shooting wherever they were and then went mobile. And we've talked about a few of these case studies in the training we've been doing, where they drive down the street and just arbitrarily shoot at people. So that's a secondary danger outside of the actual MCI event, just creating an MCI that is all over town. And that's pretty scary.
Sam, that's really interesting that you just said that. I was at the National Disaster Life Support Summit in Atlanta, Georgia, back in July, and a gentleman by the name of Philippe Denbrock, who's with the Atlanta office of the FBI, gave a fantastic presentation on active shooter, and he does a tremendous amount of training for the FBI and training other jurisdictions, you know, municipal and local law enforcement, on this topic throughout the Southeast, and he made a very, very clear point that they're actually steering away from the title active shooter, and they're moving towards hostile intruder for just the reason you just said, is that he doesn't want to sort of pigeonhole the command officer into thinking, oh, well, you know, we're not hearing any booms anymore, so therefore it's over, because a lot of, if you look at outside of Pittsburgh, the student in the high school had stabbed 22 of his classmates. So, you know, it was a stabbing, and the IEDs are becoming more and more of a threat with the internet and unfortunately the ability for people to craft their own. So absolutely, that the term active shooter is actually sort of, they're trying to get that to dissolve into hostile intruder, because you just don't know what they have.
Yeah, boy, that's a fact. I mean, Joe, would you agree that this is sounding more and more like when you're starting to involve the IEDs and so forth? It's really sounding more like a terrorist event than just a simple homegrown shooter. Would you agree with that?
I think there's no question that the lines are blurring quite a bit. You know, look at the incident with the intruder into the White House. You know, the guy had a knife, but there's not a reason in the world he couldn't have had a bomb strapped to him as well. So, you know, was that guy a terrorist or an intruder or crazy or all the above? I don't know the answer to that, but I think there's no question that these events are, the lines are blurring, and it's unfortunately just the nature of the beast nowadays that we have to be prepared for responses to events that in the past were pretty much unheard of. And the only way to stay ahead of that curve is to change the way we do things. And there's just no question in my mind at all, we've absolutely got to adopt these new approaches to these instances if we're going to make a difference in saving the lives of patients.
And train our people to levels they never aspired to go, basically.
Well, I think you're right, Sam, although I do think it's really important, and it's not really part of tonight's topic, I suppose, but, you know, I get a lot of pushback, feedback, and questions from especially the fire community about, well, we need to get our guys, you know, bulletproof vests and helmets and all this other kind of stuff. And it's very frustrating to try to have that conversation with somebody who's absolutely convinced that if there's somebody at the other end of the mall with a gun, then everybody that needs to go in the mall all needs to be wearing, you know, Kevlar protection. And I'm not trying to dismiss that. Obviously, if you're in a spot where bullets are flying at you, then you clearly need to be under that kind of protection. But active shooter events are not like that. They certainly can be if you happen to be in the room where the shooter is. But beyond that, these are not war zones in the classic sense of the word. And I think it's a really important distinction to make, because I think we get really sidetracked with this whole idea of I've got to don all my, you know, helmet and everything else before I, you know, go into the movie theater when the shooter is, you know, either already dead or, you know, two buildings away and hardly posing a threat to that immediate area. So I'm convinced that we can do these things with a very high degree of safety and security, and that we don't need to get ourselves sidetracked with a lot of conversation about you know, the dangers associated with going into those environments. You know, I look at that as from an EMS and fire standpoint of saying to those folks, your bulletproof vest is the law enforcement officer standing in front of you with a gun. You know, he's not going to let anybody come at you. He's not going to let anybody get close enough to you to shoot you. That's his job. So that's your armor. Now let's go. We got to go take care of patients. So, you know, I think it is just a matter of keeping those two perspectives clear, but I certainly appreciate it's very difficult when these events, you know, tend to have very blurred lines between, you know, a military action, terrorist threat, crazy guy with a gun, or, you know, a prank in many cases. It is awfully hard to separate those things out. So it clearly takes an awful lot of very astute people in the field who are very well trained and who trust each other and who know how to work together so that you can move on past those trust and fear issues quickly to be able to get the response made that you need to make.
Joe, we've talked about this on the show before, talking about this paradigm shift that you just were referring to, where we need to change the way we think about these types of things. And I'm curious, Bob, from your standpoint, you know, you're out there and we really haven't come at it from this angle, but I'm curious. We wonder about how many systems out there are actually really making the change and really getting the concept internalized in their culture and making these shifts where they're actively training alongside police and fire, and they're putting these practices into place so that when the problem arises, they're ready for it. When you go out there with your products, obviously you get a sense of how many people are interested in what you have to offer, and that would be maybe a sense of how many organizations are actually making the shift.
Yeah, and that's, Jamie, it's funny. We're seeing this, you know, this product literally is hitting the streets officially this week, but we have been out showing it to select audiences for the last couple, several months now. And it's funny, it's just now, if I had a dime for every time I walked into a conference room, you know, in either a volunteer station or a chief's office at 9 o'clock in the morning in a career outfit, it's oh my God, I just had this conversation last night. You know, it's, oh my gosh, I wish you were here yesterday because we just talked about this. And it's just now starting to pick up momentum. We're just now hearing really across the country, it's definitely in everyone's thought process, and they're now starting to look at next steps. And you know, we developed this product, again, based upon what I saw as an initial need in my community. And then when I started doing the research, it's amazing how I wasn't alone. And we're seeing now more and more people are reaching out and doing a lot of research on the web and looking at the communities that are really starting to take off with it. I know the Arlington, Virginia area has done a tremendous job, and their medical direction out there is, they've really started to adopt it. And you're seeing thought leaders across the country who are becoming more and more vocal, and they're getting a bigger and bigger audience because It is a hot topic right now, and people are trying to become prepared.
Well, it sounds like that's exactly what I wanted to hear. I mean, this is something, like I said, we've been talking about here off and on, good grief, Joe, since the very first days of this podcast. I think one of our earliest topics was on a hostile intruder incidents and mass casualties. And so it's nice to see that the systems are starting to pay attention and get it down. But it really comes down to that cross training with other response agencies in your area.
I think you're exactly right. It is absolutely all about the training, and that's the only way things are going to change. And I think that's just one of the real strong points of Bob's product, is that it's very forward thinking. It's very it's straightforward. It's intuitive, and by its very nature helps to push the structural and cooperative process forward. It's not just a new tool to go take care of a particular problem, but it's a system that's designed to not only deal with the physical wound of the patient, but the extrication component, the cooperative tie-in to law enforcement and everything else. So to me, this thing really just works so nicely in giving folks a way to put that structure in place very quickly and having sort of everything you need in one spot and be ready to go with it you literally open the top, hand out a few things, and everybody's ready to get rolling within seconds. And I think that helps drive not only the training, but obviously the response itself, because it's just like having everything there that you need to take care of this problem. And I think that's the kind of stuff that really is going to make things move forward, is this has made it simple, easy, and intuitive.
And the command structure is really what sort of takes it to that, and, you know, next level. Any kind of, you know, this paradigm shift obviously, you know, brings people who want to challenge it. And you know, Dr. Holly touched on it earlier, and I think both Sam, you and Jamie have mentioned it, that, you know, with change comes resistance, especially in the fire service. We're known for it, right? And so it's one of those things that the people who will object initially to this thought process and this paradigm shift is they say, you know, well, like Dr. Holly said, it's just, I'm not going to go into something that's not safe. It's, you know, the law enforcement's job is to go and mitigate that, and we need to know it's 100% safe before we go in. But, you know, my answer to that is on the fire service side, you know, we go up and we vent roofs on burning buildings, right? But we don't go up there just willy-nilly and get up there if we don't, we have decisions that we make in order to send people up there. And, you know, there are things that we have to check off in our mind or on paper before we send a crew to go vent a roof. And we're looking for indicators, we're looking for smoke, we're looking for fire, we're looking to see where it is in the structure, and we do that. And then once they vent the roof, they don't hang out there and chat, they come back down, right? It's a very strategic maneuver. And that's exactly what this is. And so this is a strategic maneuver to go in, treat the treatable, and get them out. And the commander gives you all the cues you need to make those incident objectives that are specific to your incident. And that's really the key. And we're not just handing, you know, a first aid kit to someone and tell them to run in, you know, duck low and get the, you know, help the people. We're not doing that. We're giving them the tools they make from start to finish to make it a success, to make it safe, and to get the injured out.
Yeah, I think Bob touched on a really important part there. It's not just, you know, here's a first aid kit, go in there and start saving lives, but the rest of that product, i.e. that cooperative interaction with law enforcement, et cetera, is the safety net, and is absolutely vital to the system working properly. You can't expect people to run in place where somebody's shooting and say, you know, just go in there and get all those people out. Nobody's asking anybody to do that. But in a cooperative effort with law enforcement, with both sides doing their job, you can do that, and you can do that with very high levels of safety and very quickly. And, you know, I think that's the key difference here, is you have to look at that, again, just like Bob said. Nobody's going to expect anybody to take a fire hose and throw a ladder up and jump on a roof of a house that's burning down without some training, some knowledge, some critical skills and judgment on the safety associated with that. And, you know, it's all about assessing the risk and dealing with the problem. And I think the reason that we've had an awful lot of pushback and reluctance from the fire service is that they don't understand that risk very well. That's not something they deal with every day. Obviously, that's a law enforcement thing. And, you know, and our history is we'll stay a couple blocks away till all that shooting stops, and you call us and we'll come pick everybody up. But I think that's what's really got it. That is what has to change. There's just no doubt about it, that if we don't get those changes made, we're going to continue to have ever-escalating death tolls from these things, and we're going to have a hard time, you know, justifying our existence to some extent if we can't get in and mitigate these very high-profile, very tragic events.
Sam, you had some thoughts. I know you're probably chomping at the bit there to jump in.
Yeah, I've been trying to jump in, but this has been such a dynamic conversation. Everybody wants to keep going. But the points that both Joe and Bob have been making lately are exactly where my mind is, going back to the conversation of the points that Joe was making about should fire guys have equipment, and is it going to give them some false sense of security? I have to counter that a little bit, because let's go to the fact that fire, not all fire departments are comfortable with this thing. Even, and you know, Joe, very well, and I know this now, and Bob, you know this, that when you got force protection working, it works well. These guys are in very little danger, but there's always, they're looking at the what if. what if? I mean, one of the first scenarios we trained on was at a school in the middle of this huge quad, and there was 100 different places that an IED could be thrown out of, that there could be another bad guy that they didn't know about. So there's always that what if. And yeah, you got people around them with guns, but what if somebody shoots and a bullet gets through? So if nothing else, there's grant funding out there, and what we did with our guys is we've got four engines that we're going to have class four vests and some Kevlar helmets. And if that gives the fire chief some level of confidence, you know, where he might have been waffling on this thing, it's like, yeah, if there is a stray shot or something could happen, not likely going to happen, but if it does, then our safety is a little bit more secured, and I think it will give. Now, we haven't had any issue, really, with our guys objecting to this thing, not that I've heard. I think they think it's kind of cool that they're able to be part of this, but, you know, for those agencies that are a little more reluctant, I think if that equipment is available, it certainly can't hurt if it's going to move them into making a choice on doing it or not doing it. Does that make sense?
Oh, I think it does make sense. I mean, again, I'm not trying to dismiss anybody's reluctance and concern for safety. Obviously, it's a high-risk job. I'm just trying to make the analogy that just like firefighting has its risks, through training, preparation, cooperation, and good judgment, we can do that pretty safely. We haven't stopped deaths in the fire service, you know, on fire scenes either, because we're never going to be perfect at that. But we also have managed to do so, you know, pretty doggone safely if you look at the number of fires that these guys are involved in. So I think it's just a matter of sort of keeping that in perspective and realizing that with the same approach to this problem, we'll have similar results to what we've had with fighting another deadly foe, which is a fire.
You know, I totally agree with you there, Joe. It's just you and I and Bob and Jamie as well probably understand this better than most, but when you're trying to sell something very different, firefighters are used to going up ventilating roofs, even though that's much more dangerous than what we're talking about. But this is something brand new to them, and they have to achieve a level of comfort with it in order for their departments to jump into this kind of training. And, of course, that's what we're trying to encourage.
And absolutely. I think that's the key point there, Sam, is, you know, it's a comfort level thing, and it requires education and training. And I'm curious, Bob, you know, your connections with the federal government, you said they're really out there promoting that this needs to be, this paradigm shift has to happen, and that different regions need to be better prepared for these types of situations. Are they coming out with resources to help make these decisions?
Yeah, Homeland Security, we were just down at a conference in Tennessee, and we were actually invited to a Homeland Security, a regional meeting where they were talking about grant funding, and the liaison down in western Tennessee to the state EMA and Homeland Security office said that the deputy director had declared it the largest threat in our homeland, and you know, it was this active shooter. So they were providing resources to local agencies, everything from, you know, response handbooks. And you go into FEMA's website, they've got quite a resource available for response protocols, suggested response protocols and things. So the federal government is definitely doing everything they can, including grant funding, to assist agencies in preparing for these types of emergencies.
Well, that's great to hear, because I know, you know, there's so many resources they have out there for fire and for EMS and for other types of disaster and public health responses, that it's good to hear that Homeland Security is supporting this as well. And especially with that FBI report that just came out, that they can continue to support this, to make people more comfortable with making this shift. I'll bring it up. I'll actually have that linked in the show notes as well, so we'll make sure that people can see that. You guys have got a great website, I have to say. You know, lots of information, lots of resources. It's almost a great resource. You know, your products are there, and that's the reason you guys are in business, but you've done a good job of providing a service to the community as well, and I applaud you for that. Now, not a lot of organizations or companies do that, so thank you. Well, you know, we could probably talk about this all night. I think we've probably already turned this into a double episode of sorts. And I think that's a good thing because it's certainly something that needs to be talked about and needs to be discussed. You know, Bob, I want to thank you for taking some time and sitting down with us and chatting with us. And you know, we welcome you back on the show anytime you want to come on. If you've got something, a new report or something you'd like to talk about with regards to this topic, I think this is something we should revisit on a regular basis. Joe, where can folks find out more about what you guys are doing over at Paragon?
Well, Paragon's on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com and on Facebook as well. And our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU.
Excellent. And, you know, we want to thank Paragon, Joe, for all you guys do to support the Disaster Podcast in our efforts to get great information out there. And we could not do that without the support from Paragon Medical Education Group. So I just urge everybody that's listening to the show, head over, check out Joe's website, and you know, bring them in to bring their unique experiential training programs into your system. And one of the things Joe brings with them is toys, and toys like the Rover and other tools that you can try out and see how they work for your system.
Well, thanks, Jamie. We pride ourselves on being very cutting edge and very up to date with the products and the approaches and the procedures that we show. So thanks so much. And Bob, thank you for helping us out tonight. Paragon will actually be teaching a class in Fort Smith, Arkansas for the Arkansas Trauma Education and Research Foundation the week before Thanksgiving. So if you're in the Fort Smith area, then try to give us a shout out, and maybe somebody could drop in and do some observing, et cetera, if they'd like to.
Fantastic. We'll have to make sure we put that on the calendar and encourage folks to go to that. Sam, what about you? Where can folks find you out there on the web?
Well, I'll tell you, but I have to comment, too. You know, this subject, obviously, you can tell listening to Joe that he's very passionate about this, and I think that really does show in the training and the reason that Paragon does the training they do. And I'd like to take this discussion out a little bit further. Maybe next week we can talk a little bit more about this FBI report, which is brand new, and I'd love to talk to Joe more about what Paragon actually does in terms of training folks for this kind of event. And one of the regional events we had here a couple weeks ago that addresses the same need. So I'd love to continue this conversation next week if you guys are up for it. But in the meantime, you can find me at Sam Bradley in most places, Facebook, SamBradley11 on Twitter, and most certainly on the disasterpodcast.com website, which I hope you will visit. I hope you enjoyed this discussion, and we'd love to hear from you in terms of other things you want to hear about or any comments you may have on this episode. And I think Jamie can explain to you how we would get back to you with that information.
I definitely can, and I want to thank everybody again for checking out the show this week. You can find me under the handle PodMedic in most places on Twitter, Facebook, and other social media sites, but you can always find me as well as Sam and the rest of our guests and regular attendees to the podcast over at disasterpodcast.com, where you can find links to everything we've talked about. You want to take a look at the Rover? You want to take a look at that video that Bob talked about? There'll be a link to it in the show notes for this episode, so you can head right over there and take a look at it. This is one of the benefits of podcasting, and one of the benefits of having our site is that you can go and find the information that you need to really dig deeper into the topics that we touch on here for just 20 or 30 minutes once a week. You can dig deeper and find that information and find the additional resources that Bob talked about and Joe talked about and everything else. So when you get over there and you find those resources and they bring up a question to your mind, here's what I want you to do. I want you to put that question down in the comments area below the page. We get those comments. They email us automatically when you leave a comment there, and we can respond back to it and get a little bit of a community discussion going on. And maybe we have ideas from that for our future episodes. And so let us know what you want to hear more about. Let us know what you want us to check in more about. That's important. So in any case, this is the podcast. Disasterpodcast.com is where you can find us. And we want to thank all of you for checking out the program. And, you know, Sam, we talked about hostile intruders and mass casualty incidents, but it's really all disaster medicine in one form or another.
Yes, and unfortunately, it's not always natural disasters. It's the kind of disasters that we wish we didn't have. We can't stop tornadoes, but hopefully someday we'll stop this kind of activity. But it's pretty clear that disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.